Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guy's lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows. Everybody knows the boat is leaking. Everybody knows the captain line. Everybody knows this broken feeling. Like the father of their dog just died. Everybody talking to their pockets. They want a box of chocolates and a long stem rose. Everybody knows. Everybody knows that you love me, baby. Everybody knows you really do. Everybody knows that you've been faithful, give up. Give or take a maid or two. Everybody knows you've been less curry, but there were so many people you just had to meet without your clothes. Everybody knows.
That was Leonard Cohen, Everybody Knows. And this is Truth Quest with Melody, and this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And tonight I have with me Janet Phelan. I hope I'm saying that right. Janet, are you there?
Oh, yes, I certainly are. Oh,
okay. Because I heard somebody else pronounce your name differently today, so I thought maybe I'd double check. But anyways, Janet is a research journalist and radio host, and anything else there to add?
I am an investigative reporter with the American's Bulletin, which is a national op-ed paper published out of Medford, Oregon. And just about 2.5 months ago, I picked up a radio show, and I am now the proud host of One If by Land, which airs on KSKQ, which is in Ashland, Oregon, every Wednesday from 5 to 6 p.m. Pacific time.
And do you have a website at all?
KSKQ has a website. KSKQ streams from kskq.org, and the American's Bulletin has a sort of a skeletal website kind of telling what the paper's about. It is essentially a hard copy paper.
Okay.
I myself do not have my own website.
Okay, all right. And KHEN is also streamed on the Internet at khen.org. Janet, let's kind of get into a little bit of your background before we get started on the issue that you're writing about currently.
Okay. I've been a journalist over 25 years. I'm beginning to think it's probably 30, and it's causing me to gnash my teeth to realize I am of that vintage now. I did my graduate work in journalism at the University of Missouri, Columbia, and I have written for numerous publications, mostly freelance, although I've had a couple of staff jobs. I have written for the Los Angeles Times, Santa Monica Daily Press, We Magazine, Long Beach Press Telegram, Air California, and back in 2004, I was a columnist at the Santa Monica Daily Press, and I started, I kind of stepped into it. I started to research something that is relevant to the Critical Infrastructure Information Protection Act and also to the Patriot Act, and I was very quickly ended up without any association with the Santa Monica Daily Press, very quickly. And at that point, I began to realize what I had already gravely suspected, which is our media is largely controlled. And Santa Monica Daily Press is not a corporate media in the sense of, you know, being owned by Rupert Murdoch or any of the large conglomerates. It's simply a small operation that is, I believe at that point, was owned by three partners. And what I learned when I stepped into it in Santa Monica was that certain subject matters are simply verboten. And there's certain things that if you attempt to research and report on them, you will find yourself very quickly no longer employable in the media. I am very, very grateful to the American's Bulletin for their fearlessness in pursuit of the truth and in providing venues for articles that are simply verboten now in terms of what the mainstream media finds acceptable. And one of these stories, not as seriously prohibited as what I was attempting to deal with in Santa Monica, but one of these touchy stories now is in terms of what's happening in the courts in terms of the conservatorship and guardianship programs. And the reporting on these issues, on this issue, has been spotty at best. There has been a general stand down on honest reporting on this issue. There are a couple of papers that have sort of skirted around the issue carefully. The most notable was the publication in the Los Angeles Times, beginning, I believe it was in November of 2005, when they ran a series called Guardians for Profit, when a family member, a family matter becomes a business, which is about this conservatorship issue.
Before you go any further, and speaking of, the views expressed on this program are those of myself and or my guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the KHAN staff, volunteers, or board of directors. Okay. Just have to say that.
Well, now that we've gotten that caveat out of the way, I'd like to take a moment to kind of explain what a conservatorship is, because there are many of the listening audience who may not be aware of that, and I certainly wasn't. As recently as 6 or 7 years ago. Conservatorships are generally initiated through the court in order to ostensibly protect a person who is vulnerable, either elderly or disabled. There has to be some sort of allegations of lack of capacity in order for a conservatorship to be initiated. And supposedly, and the conservatorships, and they're sometimes called guardianships, are initiated in every state of the union. As I said, to provide protection for people who are considered vulnerable. But the reality behind this process is revealing a legally sanctioned cottage industry where there is massive fraud and abuse by the very parties pledged to oversee and protect. Now, obviously, where you have a situation where somebody may have quite a bit of money, as a number of elderly people do, and somebody steps in as a conservator to marshal that person's assets. What happens when a person goes under a conservatorship is that all of their assets are transferred to the conservator. So they no longer have access to their own bank accounts. They don't have access to their safety deposit boxes. And if it's also a conservatorship of person, not just of estate, the conservator will also be making all the personal decisions for the conservatee, where that person lives, who they can associate with. If the conservator decides to sell off the person's property, then the conservatee really has no voice in that.
Is that different than the durable or medical power of attorney?
Yes, it is.
Okay.
Medical powers of attorney may be granted to a conservator, and in that case, a conservator can make the medical decisions for the conservatee. But a medical power of attorney is limited, usually in scope, for the making of medical decisions. But what we're seeing in these conservatorships is that, well, I believe in California they call it the power of health care, is very often granted then to the conservator, who also has control over all the money. And in a situation where you have that much power over someone who essentially no longer has a voice in their own affairs, and when there's money in the mix, one can see where this is could be a field that would be open to some sort of corruption.
How do these usually come about?
Well, a conservatorship is initiated when there are allegations of lack of capacity or a vulnerability, and there are several ways that this can happen. Very often when you have an elderly person with family members, a family member may realize that their parent or whatever is not paying so much attention to the purse strings, and sometimes grown children start leeching off the money. And sometimes they steal. And if the police get involved, then what you have is a perceived rift in the family. And very often a professional conservator or guardian, the words are sort of interchangeable, will be appointed because there's allegations that the person is, you know, is being robbed. So that's one way that it can happen. If Adult Protective Services gets involved because of allegations of financial abuse or physical abuse, it can also open the door for the professional conservator.
Now, is this sometimes abused in the way that these come about?
Oh, well, yes. One of the things that was brought to light in the LA Times series concerning the conservatorship of Helen Jones, which was featured in the first of the LA Times series, Guardians for Profit, was that Helen Jones went under a conservatorship when somebody showed up at her door and got her signature on papers that Helen Jones thought were to reduce her utility bill. So all you need is a signature from someone saying, I'd like to have this person do my bookkeeping for me. I think I'm not as up to speed as I used to, and I would like this person to take care of my check writing. And in the case of Helen Jones, it's very possible that she was given some false information about what she was signing, which is something we have seen over and over again as well. And as soon as you have that signature, which is nominating a person to quote-unquote take care of you, then you basically have turned over your sovereignty almost.
They don't require... Do they not require any kind of witnessing or notary or something of that sort for those kind of notes?
I have not seen where there is a notarizing of these nominations.
Mm-hmm.
I have not. There may be some states where notarizing is necessary, but the nominations that I have viewed in the court files are not notarized.
That's interesting.
Right. What happens then is a temporary conservatorship is initiated, and usually it has a time limit. And in that time limit, the conservator kind of scrambles to get his or her ducks in order to achieve permanent conservatorship. And very often these conservators have particular doctors that they use to get the required signatures for incompetency, lack of capacity. All the assets are transferred then over to the conservator, and if the conservatee wishes to have an attorney to combat this conservatorship, the conservatee, even the temporary conservatee, has at that point no funds to really pay for an attorney of his or her choice. So usually what happens, because all the funds have gone to the conservator, is that the court appoints an attorney from a panel of court-affiliated attorneys in order to, quote-unquote, you know, represent the conservatee. And what we have seen in the situations where there are hot spots, which means where the corruption has become endemic and systematized, is that the court-appointed attorneys will do their due diligence to make sure that the conservatee remains in the conservatorship. And for their due diligence, they are given, you know, authorized by the court certain legal fees which are paid from the estate. So what we have really, what we're seeing is a closed system in many, many venues Whereas as soon as a person becomes a temporary conservatee, they're in it for life. And it is almost, not entirely impossible, but almost impossible once one goes under a temporary conservatorship to regain one's status as a person who can make one's own decisions and live one's own life.
So you're saying that not only the individual, but even the family members will have a hard time getting, guardianship back.
Well, at the point, it's not so much getting guardianship back, mm-hmm. but getting one's life back and one's rights back.
Okay.
Because really, what conservatorship is, essentially, is it is a civil rights issue, and the class of people who are being stripped of their rights are the elderly. Now, it is true that there are many elderly people who have age-related disabilities, Alzheimer's, dementia, etc. But this is but there are many who do not, and the fact that so many do, this is just simply being taken as gospel truth. If a person goes, such as a conservator, goes to court and says, well, these allegations are true, and that's it, and that's the way it stands. So there really doesn't seem to be any other situation going on in our country where a person can lose all their rights simply because someone has made an allegation that they were wronged, which is, you know, when I mentioned earlier that a family member may start leeching off the estate. All that is needed for a conservatorship to be initiated is an allegation of this sort.
So they don't even have to prove it or anything then?
No, they don't have to.
Okay.
Mm-mm.
And this can happen even in, I notice you mentioned instances in your articles about younger individuals or disabled and that sort that kind of get caught up into this trap some, correct?
Right. Conservatorship or guardianship is initiated when there are allegations of lack of capacity. And if a person is younger and disabled, then or allegedly disabled, then these can be initiated for a younger person as well. There's a situation right now that is going on in Portland, Oregon, which I think really illuminates a great deal of the real impetus behind these conservatorships. There is a woman named Susan DeMuro, who I believe at this point is about 49 years old. She's a college graduate. She's the mother of, I believe, four children. And she had married a very wealthy man who was a developer. He was all hooked up with the Republican Party. He owned businesses across country. He was very, very well situated financially. And Susan and Art DeMuro were going through a divorce. And Art DeMuro had his wife, Susan, put under a conservatorship during the divorce proceedings. And she was essentially, I can say she appears to have been robbed of her divorce settlement because she could not hire an attorney to speak for her. She had to go with who was appointed by the court, blah, 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 and she ended up just being shafted in terms of her divorce settlement. Now, I have met Susan DeMuro, and I have also looked at the psychiatric records that she provided, which were also offered to the court concerning this extremely bright, very verbal. And, I mean, I'll tell you, to look at Susan DeMuro, you'd think you're looking at a Vogue model. I mean, a very attractive, very well-dressed, very well-spoken woman with psychiatric reports, which were all except one of them, all except one were basically saying that she was, you know, bright, well put together, no capacity problems. There was one psychiatrist that was appointed by the court who appeared to have been a hitman who was kind of shuffling around with this, well, she could be this or she could be that. But the other despite that one report, the other two reports on her mentality were stunningly positive, and that basically saying that she's completely adequate.
So all it took was one person to put her in jeopardy for her being able to be on her own.
The judge in that case, it was Judge Meisenheimer, chose not to pay attention to the two reports, which were revealing that Susan DeMuro was quite competent, and to only give weight to the one report that said, well, we don't know about that so much. So this is what happened in terms of Susan DeMuro. Now, I have, besides meeting her last year, I've had other communications with her, and she is just having a heck of a time getting out from under this. She's already been rooked. She's already, you know, lost the monies which should have been afforded her after those years and years of marriage. And she's trying desperately to get out from under this burden, these shackles of conservatorship. And she had, per my recollection, she was able to get the conservatorship transferred to her father, and then followed the court dictates, noticed all the parties, the conservatorship is being abolished, and nobody objected except the judge objected, and the judge did not want to set her free. So we have, again, a situation where there appears to be some influence going on where the judges and other parties who are there to oversee and protect are actually not doing so. And this lack of protection, where we see judges and other parties colluding with conservatorship, is where a lot of the real issue lies.
How did you get acquainted with this?
I became aware of this because of what happened to my own mother, Dr. Amalie Phelan, under a corrupt conservatorship in Riverside Court. And it was up until this happened to my own mother, I was first of all unaware of this process. I was unaware that if my mother got involved in a process like this, it would be an invitation for pillaging, plundering, and worse. And it was simply the most frightful, corrupt process that ended up really being fatal for my mother.
So what you're alluding to is the fact that this may be somewhat of an organized type of situation that can be taking place at times?
What we're seeing in the hot spots, and I used that word before, that there are certain counties in America where they have systematized and streamlined the process to the detriment of the rights of the people going under conservatorship. And when it becomes systematized, what we're seeing is that the points of protection, the linchpins of protection, which would be, let's say, the judges, the district attorneys, the adult protective services, the police, we see that those institutions in the areas that are hotspots have been compromised. If you go to in Redlands, California, and San Bernardino County is one of the hot spots. If you go to the police with a report that one of the embedded conservators, let's say Melody Scott or Larry Dean, that they have committed a crime against a conservatee, if you have evidence of the crime, the police will bury the report. If you go to the San Bernardino District Attorney's Office, and I was able to nail this down fairly recently. If you go to the San Bernardino District Attorney's Office with allegations of criminal activity by an embedded conservator, then they'll take the report, but the report will not go into the main system, and the report will not be given a report number. Now, what this means in terms of a report number, which sounds like a technicality, is actually extremely important, because whenever you make a report to a justice agency, if it be the police, DA, attorney general, you get a report number. And if you do not get one, and if the agency refuses to assign one, then you can be pretty well assured that the report is not in the system. And what we checked with the San Bernardino District Attorney's Office when a report was filed earlier this year is one of the clerks, who had no idea that there was some hanky-panky going on, did reveal that, a couple weeks after the report was filed, that there was no such report in the system, that the parties involved, given the names of the alleged perpetrators, the names of the alleged victims, did not appear in the system. And when we had requested a report number for this report, we were denied a report number. So what this means is that there is a shadow file, that certain reports coming in with certain alleged perpetrators are being passed over. They are not in the system. They are not part of any sort of database of criminality. So what this indicates is that there is a level of influence that some parties have been able to achieve. And this is what I call a get-out-of-jail-free card. We saw that Scooter Libby had a get-out-of-jail-free card. Well, apparently these cards are being passed down at other levels as well. And given the research I did simply on Redlands Court, where all of the probate conservatorships in San Bernardino County, which is the largest county in the United States, all of the probate conservatorships are now funneled through Redlands Superior Court. And if you have allegations concerning criminal activity by one of the embedded conservators or of their embedded attorneys, then none of those will be prosecuted. And they simply, the district attorney and other justice agencies, are finessing these reports by not assigning report numbers, funneling them into a shadow system.
Well, how are you able to do any research on these if there aren't any report numbers to follow up with? Where do you find the documentation at?
Well, what I did was the American Bulletin sent me down to San Bernardino County, and between October and December of last year, I spent 2 months going through the probate conservatorship file. And this embedded conservator group that I mentioned, which is actually CARE Incorporated in San Bernardino County, is pretty much cornering the market now on probate conservatorships. And they're involved, the estimate is between 60% and 70% of the conservatorships and estate administrations going on in San Bernardino County. And I looked through the files, I took names, I took, if there were names of family members, I took and addresses and phone numbers, I took those. And I contacted family members. And I would hear stories, well, you know, we called the police and we called Adult Protective Services, and then you follow through and you call the district attorney's office and you talk to a clerk and you say, this is the name of the perpetrator, after you know that a report has been filed. And it doesn't show up. And then I myself, simply to do a test run, after going through the files in Redlands, there was one particular case where there was obvious financial abuse, fraud, embezzlement, whatever particular term you want to use. It was obvious in this case file. And I took it upon myself to make a police report and also to contact the district attorney. And lo and behold, 2 weeks later, I call back, I get a clerk, and the clerks are great because they're not as embedded, they're not as often
But aren't they the ones that file the report numbers?
Often, if you hit a random clerk who is not part of the higher cabals of power, they won't know. And if you ask, hey, look up this name, and they'll tell you, oh, there's nothing there.
Okay.
And I've heard this over and over. Yeah. I myself have a letter from this is where it goes on up the ladders of power. There were reports that numerous reports that have gone into the California Attorney General's office concerning this conservator group, the CARE Incorporated, that I have mentioned in Redlands. And I have a letter in response to about 150 pages of reports, documentation that went into the California DOJ last year, and I have a letter back from Mark Geiger, who's the Senior Assistant Attorney General, in response to the reports. And he states in his letter, I simply don't have the developed criminal expertise to deal with these allegations.
So now you're saying that even at that level they may be involved?
Mark Geiger refused to give a report number to the reports that came in. I have those reports myself on file. And when he was contacted by me and asked for the report number, he wouldn't give one. So once again, shadow file. Now, why in the world would the California Attorney General want to cover up crimes that are being committed down in Redlands, California, where there are allegations of financial abuse, allegations of fraud, allegations of embezzlement, et cetera. Why would the California Attorney General's office want to sit on reports like this?
So you're saying that it's much more widespread in California?
Well, California, my greatest database on this is California. I am aware of issues going on across the country in terms of conservatorship abuse. In fact, there have been a couple of national groups formed recently to deal and combat this issue because it has become so widespread. One is the, I believe it's the Advocates for National Guardianship Ethics and Reform. I believe another group is the National Association to Stop Guardian Abuse. And these are culling members from all over the country because this issue has become so widespread. Just about 2 months ago, I was down in San Francisco for a couple of days, and I was walking down Telegraph Avenue. I went to Berkeley back when the dinosaurs were and I was, revisit. I hadn't been back there in years, and I'm walking down Telegraph Avenue and looking all the funky jewelry and T-shirts and stuff, and I stopped to talk to a jeweler was, making these neat little earrings. And a woman walked up, and she started talking about how upset she was because her mother was under a conservatorship and she couldn't see her mother anymore because the conservator told her she couldn't see her mother. I mean, if you keep your ears open, you'll be hearing these stories that are becoming louder and louder because this issue has been moving, it's been a trickle for a number of years, these sort of issues, but it's really gathering force and velocity, and the trickle is becoming a river.
So you're saying the conservator can keep the family away from the their loved one?
Yes. There are basically, I believe, two types of conservatorships or guardianships. One is of a state, which means that they marshal they take all the money, and the other I'm not laughing, it's really very tragic. The other is a conservatorship of person, where they make all of the personal decisions for the conservatee, and in the conservatorships of person, they can deny access of the family. One of the things that we have seen being deployed over and over, which is terribly disturbing is that the conservator may go to court and get restraining orders against members of the family, particularly if the family member, if the conservator is very corrupt and the family member starts to
ask questions,
document. There's a situation going on right now with the family of one of these care in Southern California. One of the attorneys, J. David Horsbull, who's one of the main attorneys for CARE Incorporated, put his own father under conservatorship. And it really kind of blew apart the family and the adult children. David Horsbull's brothers and sisters have kind of divided into camps. It's the pro-conservatorship and the anti-conservatorship camps. And a couple of parties in a brother in the anti-conservatorship camp started documenting behaviors that looked pretty abusive and began to take photographs and so on. And the next thing he knew, his brother, attorney David Horsbull, went to court and got a restraining order against the brother who was documenting alleged abuses by David Horsbull to his own father. Now, if you're dealing with situations that are streamlined and what we're calling, again, the hot spots, the judges are part of the problem. And so the judges grant the restraining orders. So the protective person, the protective son or daughter, will be kept away from the conservatee, their own parent.
Why don't you get into that one about the disabled boy and what happened to him and with his family?
Are you talking about Stevie Price?
Yes.
Yeah. Stevie Price was, I believe, 9 years old when he was taken to the emergency room. I guess there was like a little bit of an injury, and he, due to a hospital foul up, he became brain injured, and his parents, Steve Price and Faye, sued Loma Linda Hospital, and they won several million dollars in terms of how, because of their child was now permanently brain injured, and Steve and Faye, I believe, were breaking up, and they were having a custody battle, and Steve Price is the elder, and Stevie Price was the brain-injured son. And Steve noticed during this custody battle that there was an attorney sitting in the back of the courtroom taking notes. And it turned out that this attorney was Walter Moore, who's one of the CARE attorneys. And the next thing they knew, the judge had decided that an impartial third party needed to be appointed to speak for Stevie Price. And this impartial third party, I believe, was Walter Moore, the attorney. And at that point, Walter Moore immediately nominated one of the CARE conservators, Melody Scott, as guardian of Stevie's person. And very quickly, Melody Scott gained control over Stevie's multimillion-dollar trust. She was appointed temporary guardian, and she used $300,000 of Stevie's trust for attorney's fees and expert witness fees and all that to get herself appointed permanent guardian. So at that point, she had control over this multi-million dollar, award that was meant to last Stevie Price for the rest of his life. And things got pretty ugly pretty quickly. Now, Steve Price, the elder Steve Price, had enrolled his son Stevie in a medical insurance plan, major risk medical insurance program, with Medi-Cal as a secondary insurance. and a chunk of Stevie's malpractice settlement had already gone to settle his Medi-Cal bill and to enable his enrollment in this major risk medical insurance program, which was felt to be really the best case scenario for Stevie. It was less than $100 as a monthly premium. There was no payback requirement on death, and also this MRMIP program provided a far higher standard of care than Medi-Cal would have. So upon receiving guardianship over Stevie, this Melody Scott person voluntarily removed Stevie from this program. Now, this severely limited his medical care to what the Bare Bones Medi-Cal program would cover.
Are you there? Whoops. Well, I guess maybe I'll have to put something else on here so we can get her back. So. I haven't had that happen before. Okay. Let's just see if we can get her back here in just a second. You there, Janet?
I am here.
Okay. Oh, I think we might have got it worked out, maybe.
I can hardly hear you, Melody.
Okay. Let's see if we can get something adjusted here.
Maybe I can move up my... Hello?
Okay. You got it now?
Yeah, you're a little faint. Am I faint, too?
No. No.
Good.
This... Hopefully, we're going to be replacing this board here pretty soon. So it could be a possibility that that's what's going on. But except for the phone not working, that was a little bit different. So it would pick up kind of where we. While I'm at it, we're close to the hour break. So I'll go ahead and say that this is KHENLP 106.9 Salida. And this is Truth Quest with Melody, and my guest tonight is Janet Phelan, and she is a research journalist, and we've been talking about conservatorships and some of the problems that crop up.
Yes, and I was giving some detailed information about one particular case, the case of a disabled, brain-injured young man named Stevie Price. And I went into some great detail, and suddenly I realized you had been very quiet for a very long time. We had lost each other, so I don't know where you lost me, because I went into such exquisite detail.
Oh, dear. I'll see if I can try to pick up here. He was... the father, I mean, they were using the money of Stevie's up, and that the medical, they'd stopped the medical.
Right. They had stopped the good insurance, which was MRMIP, and put him on Medi-Cal, and reduced his level of care. Reduced what would be covered for his medical needs, and then did I go into the issue about the tracheotomy?
No.
Okay, this is where it got really, pretty shocking. What happened was, most institutional facilities, which would be appropriate for someone with Stevie's injuries, generally only accept patients with tracheotomies. And at that point, Stevie didn't have a tracheotomy. His doctor didn't feel he needed a tracheotomy. In fact, nobody thought he needed a tracheotomy except his conservator. At that point, Stevie Price was living with his dad, Steve, who was taking care of him, and there was a lot of conflict between the conservator, Melody Scott, and the elder Steve Price as to the kind of care, what was happening with the money, why his son wasn't getting the appropriate medical treatment, and Steve Price does believe that Melody Scott went to court and applied to get a tracheotomy for the sole purpose of getting Stevie away from his father. Melody Scott failed to provide to the court any diagnostic proof of the necessity of this tracheotomy. And in defiance of the opinion of Stevie's long-term pulmonary specialist and home health nurses, she just went to court and said, we need this tracheotomy, and the judge granted it. And Steve Price, the elder Steve Price, feels that this was also one of the factors in his son's untimely death. And there was necessary medical care that was withheld because of the reduction of care when the conservator put him on Medi-Cal. Also, the Medi-Cal claim incurred over $500,000, which needed to be paid back when Stevie died. There wasn't even that money left in the trust to cover that. And the final thing that I went into here was that that Steve Price did discover that Melody Scott had attempted to apparently further pad her pocket by taking out two burial plots on young Stevie, one of which went unreported to the court. And one of the things that we have realized about Melody Scott is she generally does take out more than one burial plot on her clients and fails to report the second one to the court. And that way, when the person dies, she can just cash it in and keep the money. So this situation, which is a very shocking situation, it simply replicates itself over and over. And when I went through those files in Redlands, over and over, I would find the family fighting against the conservator to get control over their loved one back. And they were, statements were that the loved one was getting harmed, and the loved one was not having their needs met, and the loved one was, that money was disappearing, and nobody would account for it. And over again, in Redlands Court, we see the judge, which is primarily Judge Michael Welch, rubber stamping all decisions made by Melody Scott, even with evidence such as this, with the doctor saying he doesn't need a tracheotomy, and the judge says, go for it. And so there seems to be sort of a dual thing going on here, because where there's money involved, and the money gets transferred to the conservator, then we see money just flying out of the estates in some very, very disturbing ways. But we also see that the conservatees are apparently dying before their time.
What about?
And very often we see the conservatee dying when the money runs out.
What about the other case that you had where the lady had to quit work and had the disabled child? You had another instance in the information that you forwarded to me.
Was this about the Nelly Lopez case?
That sounds right. That sounds right.
Oh, well, see, this is becoming, one of those landmark situations. Nellie Lopez gave birth to a child, I believe it was in, 1980. It must have been 1980. Jackie Salazar. And there was, again, a problem with the delivery, and Jackie Salazar was horribly injured, and would be injured for the rest of her life due to some apparent hospital foul-ups. And her mother, Nellie Lopez, sued the hospital and again won a multimillion-dollar settlement. And Nellie Lopez was very dedicated to her daughter and devoted her life, the rest of her, up to this point, to caring for her daughter. She quit her job, which I believe was as a city clerk. She very carefully invested the assets. She was, very frugal, and the money began to multiply, and she devoted herself to taking care of her disabled daughter. And upon the age of 18 in New York, if an individual is disabled, it becomes a matter of course for the state to appoint a guardian. So when Jackie Salazar reached the age of majority, she was appointed a guardian. And there were statements, investigations, it was filed with the court, strong statements in support of all the wonderful care that Nelly Lopez had given her daughter, that Nelly Lopez was an intelligent and educated woman, that she had done an excellent job caring for her daughter and also taking care of the assets. Nevertheless, a stranger was appointed as a guardian. And Nelly Lopez began to balk at the intrusion of the stranger who was charging, these guardians charge quite a bit of money. In New York, the guardians are very often attorneys, and they're getting $300 an hour for making these decisions that the parent was making up until that point. So there began to be some real friction between Nelly Lopez and the guardians. And at this point, as of last year, I guess Nelly Lopez really began to bridle against all this. And the guardian, who is now Mary Rosado, who is an attorney in New York, began to make noises about taking Jackie Salazar away from her mother and putting her in an institution. Well, Nelly Lopez, around Christmas time, she picked up her daughter and she booked. And the guardian doesn't know where Nelly Lopez and Jackie Salazar are. And at this point, it appears to have become a rather serious issue out there in New York. There have been, I guess, contempt charges filed. There may have been charges filed of absconding with a disabled adult. I'm not sure that the exact wording, but the FBI has gotten involved. And I have been contacted by Nelly Lopez's her nephew named Dave Lopez. And Dave and I have spoken on the phone. He sent me some court papers and some other stuff. And Dave Lopez has begun to experience harassment and intimidation. He is claiming that he has been approached at his home, at his workplace, by people he believes are private investigators. They may be private investigators. They may be in federal employ. I'm really not sure of that. He's actually been photographing them. It got so intense that he left his home in the city and went to stay outside the city with a girlfriend. At that point, the private eyes began showing up at his work and tailing him. So he began to do this, jumping the train, this community train, that, just so that they, just to shake them. And he was also contacted by a psychic named Jackie Barrett, who began to offer him money. Started at $5,000, according to Dave Lopez, it went up to $20,000, if he would tell her where Nelly Lopez and Jackie Salazar are. Now, Jackie Salazar is a young woman who is severely injured. What is really remarkable about all this is that Jackie Salazar is worth a heck of a lot of money. And Mary Rosado, as the guardian, is pursuing Jackie Salazar the way someone would pursue a pot of gold. And the fear is, at this point, that if Nelly Lopez surfaces with Jackie Salazar, the fear is that Nelly Lopez will go to jail for taking a trip with her daughter, eluding the guardian, attempting to protect her daughter from institutionalization. And it is very clear by looking at the court records that that is where the court and Mary Rosado are moving. They are moving to place Jackie Salazar in an institution.
And what was the instance with the one that was getting the abuse inside the institution that...
I'm sorry, that wasn't quite clear.
Okay, you had a case also where there was child or person that was being had a conservatorship was getting abused inside the institution.
Yes, that's the case of Nancy Golin. This is another a very shocking and nearly landmark case. Nancy Golin is autistic, and she is the only child of Jeff and Elsie Golin. They are in Northern California. And Nancy Golin was removed from her parents after, well, she went and took a walk. I mean, basically that's what she did. She took a walk, she wandered off, she returned home on her own, but given the fact that she had wandered off, the Golins, I rather appropriately called the police. And Nancy came back on her own accord, and the police decided that they were going to take Nancy to a hospital for a welfare check. Well, she never came home. And in the hospital, I believe it was Stanford Hospital in Palo Alto, the doctors were unaware of her medical history. They slashed her anticonvulsant medicine. She went into a severe bout of seizures. There was some other, you know, possible medical malpractice. And according to the Golins, in an attempt to simply cover up how badly they goofed, they decided to keep Nancy Golin. And they trumped up allegations of abuse, which were Jeff and Elsie Golin, the parents, were charged with abuse. They were arrested. All charges were dropped. They continued to keep Nancy Golin, the state did. They instituted conservatorship. And Jeff and Elsie Golin have been fighting this now for 6 or 7 years. And for a period of time, they were kept away from even seeing their daughter. And what came to their attention was, and they have been documenting the injury that Nancy Golin has suffered in state care. And she's had a collarbone fracture, she's had broken bones, she's had apparently her teeth are now falling out, she has developed tardive dyskinesia because they have put Nancy Golin, who is autistic, on those psych meds, they're antipsychotics, which cause tardive dyskinesia, which is a very disfiguring neurological disorder, which is essentially caused by drugs like Haldol and Risperdal and so on, which were never given to Nancy Golin before. And Nancy Golin has been, according to the Golins and according to their documentation, fairly badly injured in state care. And at this point, the Golins have filed a civil rights lawsuit naming San Andreas Regional Centers, Stanford Hospital, I believe it's Santa Clara County, and some other defendants. And in great illumination of what the real powers that be are here behind the scenes, one lawsuit filed against these parties, and Jeff and Elsie Golin were declared vexatious litigants. They in no way meet the standard of what a vexatious litigant is. There are certain numbers of lawsuits that have to be filed in certain numbers of years, etc., to be declared a vexatious
litigant. What is a vexatious litigant?
Well, vexatious means that basically you're irritating someone. I'm sorry, I'm laughing again, but that's what vexatious means. And what this means legally is that a person is abusing the legal system by continually filing lawsuits. Jeff and Elsie Golin filed one lawsuit. Single judge in Santa Clara County recused themselves from this case. And the Chief Justice of the State of California, Ronald George, appointed a judge to hear this case. This judge was J. Michael Byrne. And Byrne just quickly and summarily declared the Golins to be vexatious litigants and thereby dismissed the case. And this is not legal because they do not meet the standards to be declared vexatious litigants. It's spelled out very clearly in the law, and Jeff and Elsie Golan do not meet this standard at all. Now, when one is declared a vexatious litigant, if one wants to proceed with one's lawsuit, one has to therefore put up a bond. And Jeff and Elsie Golan were told that since they are now fall into this category, according to Judge Byrne, they have to put up $500,000 if they're going to pursue their lawsuit against these government entities. And they are not wealthy people, and they do not have $500,000 to pursue justice.
And so in the meantime, their child is going downhill physically.
Their child is going downhill. Their child has been injured. Their child their relationship with their child has been extremely disrupted. They're not, you know, they have been kept from seeing their child. They've been kept from caring for their child.
And they can't move that. Yeah. They can't move it to another court or another area or anything of that.
This is being prosecuted. Well, prosecuted. This is the opposing party who is. Apparently, you know, has taken on this case is the state of California.
Oh.
They're dealing with the Attorney General's office, with the same agency that Mark Geiger works for, who has declared that he won't assign report numbers and doesn't have the legal expertise to prosecute crimes. Same agency.
I've heard Florida has a little bit of a problem with this sort of thing, too.
This is a problem everywhere. Every mm-hmm. state in the union has conservatorship and guardianship laws. And there are some counties that are less corrupt, some counties that are nearly unblemished, but this is something, this process of conservatorship and conservatorship abuse is just popping up everywhere. It does appear that there is some hot spots developing in Florida as well. And actually tomorrow on my show, which is called One If I Land on KSKQ, we're going to be having an interview with Bonnie Ryder, whose mother went under a conservatorship in, I believe it's Palm Beach County. I believe that's the name of the county. Her mother never even survived to permanent conservatorship.
Uh-huh.
She was in a conservatorship, I believe, 12 weeks before she died. And what happened in this case was that Bonnie Ryder's mother, whose name was Corrine Bramson, was put into hospice without a diagnosis of terminal illness. And she was plied with morphine, and in 12 days she was dead. I have been speaking rather regularly with Bonnie Ryder. I spoke with her just again this evening, and Bonnie Ryder has been attempting to get medical records. Some of them have not been quite forthcoming, but the ones that have arrived have shown that her mother had a diagnosis of colitis, not of colon cancer. There has been no colon cancer, which is what the declaration was to funnel her into hospice. There has been no medical record that has surfaced with a diagnosis of colon cancer that has been verified. But morphine has surfaced before as a very potent way to quickly terminate someone's life. If you have an elderly person, very often morphine, if given consistently, will kill them very quickly. We saw that also in the case of Elizabeth Fairbanks, once again, under conservatorship with those care people down in Southern California, Elizabeth Fairbanks came down with pneumonia when she was under conservatorship. And it was the decision of her conservator, Melody Scott, that she not get antibiotics. Antibiotics would have very likely addressed the issue of pneumonia. During the entire course of Elizabeth Fairbanks' bout of pneumonia, she got 2 doses of antibiotics instead of usual to get like 3 or 4 doses a day. 2 doses total. She began to go into respiratory failure. At that point, a doctor on the orders of Melody Scott, the doctor's name is Dr. Victoria Raines, she began to administer Roxanol, which is an opiate. And after the second administration of the second dose of Roxanol, Elizabeth Fairbanks went into respiratory failure and died. And one of the wonderful things that Mary Beth Fairbanks, who was Elizabeth Fairbanks' daughter, did was to put all those medical records into the court file so that they can be viewed, they become public document and can be viewed by anyone. And I certainly looked very carefully at the Elizabeth Fairbanks file. And at the point where Elizabeth Fairbanks died, her estate had run out of money.
So it's easy to drain the funds out. And what about some of these homes that they were dealing with from these conservatorships?
You mean the nursing home?
No, when you were talking about they were selling the property and then having these under appraising them and then selling them for bigger gain, was that related to the same thing?
Well, it's obviously when you're looking at conservatorship of elderly people who have money, it raises questions as to what the real impetus is here, particularly when you have cases like the Elizabeth Fairbanks case. And when I began to look at the records of what was happening to what is called the probate property, I began to see a very alarming sort of repetition of certain events. The probate property, the conservatives' homes, were being vastly underassessed. Vastly. And they're selling property in San Bernardino, probate property in San Bernardino County for like $10,000-$12,000. I mean, this is considering the price of homes in many of these areas in San Bernardino County. I mean, this is a big red flag. And what is a bigger red flag is that these properties are being flipped, because you'll sell a home for, let's say, belongs to a conservatee, let's say you sell it for $20,000, which is shocking. The next year, you will see that property is sold again. At that point, it's sold for maybe $200,000. So, and the tax assessor's files in San Bernardino County will list if there has been any improvements. Now, here we have it here. I've got the list. I've got a short list right here. Elmer Archie Heath's home was appraised at $60,000. That's rather low. It was sold at $28,600. He had a vacant lot in Palm Desert. It was appraised at $8,000. Sold at $1,000. Now, if it's the job of a conservator to conserve the assets, one would have to ask why they're selling off the property at bargain basement prices. And what we're seeing is that these properties are flipping. And what that means is, you know, say it's sold, the conservatee property is sold for, let's say, $30,000. Well, the next year it's going to sell for $300,000. So obviously there's something going on here in terms of the assessments and the sales. One of the things that is very salient is that the tax assessor in San Bernardino County, and his name is Bill Postman, is now under grand jury investigation. And what we saw over and over again in San Bernardino County was that these houses were being assessed, for spare change, and sold within a year or two for greatly enhanced prices.
So who would the money be going to then?
Well, you see, there is an unseen hand here, because if I'm looking right here, Conservative Arthur Gurley's vacant Victorville lot jumped in assessed value from $7,000 to almost $45,000 when it passed hands. So as soon as it passes out of the Conservative's hands into the next buyer, into the buyer's hands, it escalates enormously. Now the question becomes, where is the money really going, and are there deals being cut?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that there really is going to need to be quite a bit more disclosure between the properties, the parties who are working as conservators and selling these properties off for almost nothing. What the relationship is between them and the parties who are buying the properties and selling them for so much money the next year, because if there is money passed in hand, it is not being reported to the court.
You know, one thing that we didn't get a chance to get into on the Stevie Price thing was when you were getting into the medical, and that he'd run up this huge $500,000 bill, and that the conservator kind of left it to the family to pay that, and
it simply was default.
Well, but it would have been left to them, okay. But if it defaulted, but in the meantime, they were funneling some money. You want to explain a little bit about where they may have come out? Did I follow that correctly? There was a certain amount of money that they were able to funnel out for themselves by not paying that bill.
What happened in the Steve Price situation was that the conservator left a bill hanging of over $500,000. There wasn't money in Steve at the time of Stevie Price's death. There wasn't money in the estate to cover the bill. And we did see where that conservator, Melody Scott, used $300,000 of Stevie's trust fund simply to get conservatorship over Stevie.
Oh, okay.
So, having spoken extensively with the elder Steve Price, and having looked at some of the financial records, one would certainly see where Melody Scott, her employees, her attorney, were being very well paid from Stevie's trust.
So, and the only reason I brought that up, it looks like, when you have these instances going on, things can disappear or be used up in many different ways.
Right, they can be used up in many different ways, and one of the things that I have been attempting to focus on in this research is what are the methods by which money is disappearing. We see, we brought up one thing earlier, you take out two burial plots on someone, don't report one of them to the court, then it's very easy as a conservator, because you have the legal right to those assets, to simply sell off the other burial plot and pocket the money. Another way that I have noted that money seems to be disappearing is through skipped check numbers. Now, a number of the court files included the general ledger of the conservators, and in this case it was CARE Incorporated, and what I noted were that there were a number of skipped check numbers in all the cases where there was a general ledger filed. Now, what does that mean? Does that mean a check was written and voided out? well, in the cases where checks were written and voided out, that was noted. And it was, there would be a column both in the credit and debit column. There would be a notation. But some of these checks, they just don't even appear. So you wonder, what is that about? Well, it does appear that, at least in some of these cases, the conservator, Melody Scott, is writing checks, not reporting them in her ledger and not reporting them to the court. So the question becomes whether all of the skip check numbers are also fall under that sort of category, which is very clearly flawed.
It seems like when you have a case like this, though, it doesn't matter whether they write the checks or not. They don't seem to be held accountable anyways.
Well, that is one of the very upsetting things, is that with the embedded conservators, it doesn't seem to matter much what they do, and their behavior in some cases is becoming extremely brazen and flagrant. And you bring it to the attention of a judge, as we mentioned before, Elizabeth Fairbanks, whose mother died because her conservator, Melody Scott, ordered that that life-saving antibiotics be withheld. Well, her daughter went to court and was attempting to protest all this, and the judge just basically said, oh, I feel your pain, and then just rubber-stamped everything Melody Scott did.
Did you ever run across anybody that she had dealt with that they were happy with her?
No.
Okay.
No, I get phone calls, I get emails. I have. I'm sorry. Her attorneys are very happy with her. the attorneys who represent her are very happy with her. But in terms of clients, in terms of family, all I have heard are nightmare stories. But she continues on, and she has been doing this now since the 80s. And she appears to be almost unstoppable.
She's an institution.
I'm sorry?
She's an institution.
Well, she's become an institution, and she has become an unassailable institution. Because if the police won't take reports or lose the reports, and we have seen that also, I have one report that was filed with the Temecula Police Department on Melody Scott, and it says, well, this is going to the Riverside DA's office. Never got there. So if she has gotten herself embedded to the point where the police are covering for her, the DA is covering for her, the Attorney General is refusing to assign report numbers, then we have something that is a very serious situation, because I have looked at the reports of alleged crimes by Melody Scott, and what we are seeing here is someone who has gotten herself completely protected. Now the question becomes, why would that be? Why would it be that somebody who is allegedly raping, pillaging, and plundering, and possibly withholding medical care and thus killing the elderly is being protected by the government? Why would that be? What function does a Melody Scott provide? What function is she serving?
I don't know.
Well, I don't know either. I have given this some thought, and there are some conclusions that could be drawn. Whether or not they are correct conclusions is entirely open to challenge. One could say, for example, that the elderly and disabled are drains on the economy. They are not productive members of society. They are drains on the entitlement system. They are sucking off Medicare and Medi-Cal and Medicaid and disability, and they're not giving anything back. And in that sense, they could be considered, useless And certainly under under a social Darwinist system, they would be considered quite dispensable. Now that's a very ugly sort of perspective, and that is certainly not something that the United States of America, its citizens, has come to expect from this government.
How many people do you think this is coming involved with this? I mean, how many cases do you think this they may be getting these funds from? So that, I mean, it's got to be a sizable number if you've got a county as big as San Bernardino.
Well, San Bernardino. Well, let's look at the United States of America. How many conservatorship cases are there in the United States of America? There are thousands right now in the state of California. This is a process that is going on in every state of the union.
Yeah, but they're not all bad.
Well, they're not all bad. But more and more, we are hearing reports that are almost mind blowing in nature. I mean, Corrine Bramson, Bonnie Ryder's mother, out in Florida, funneled into a conservatorship, put in hospice without any apparent diagnosis that is terminal, and dead in 12 days. And by the way, this conservatorship of Corrine Bramson, $300,000 disappeared into the conservatorship hole in 3 months.
That
and
pays
her daughter,
quite well.
Bonnie Ryder, has not been able to get records from the conservatorship company as to where the money went. $300,000 in 3 months. That's a lot of Band-Aids. That's a lot of Geritol.
So how would a person protect themselves from this sort of thing, or can they? It's almost as bad as getting caught up in being called a terrorist and thrown into Abu Ghraib or something. I mean,
well, it really is a civil rights issue. You know, just like the terrorist issue is also a civil rights issue. In this case, the target population are the elderly and disabled. And it's a very good question, how to protect yourself. Some people believe that preparing the right documents, the living will, the living trust, whatever, will protect one. But we're seeing more and more where courts are running over those documents as well. And one thing that I want to bring up, because I think it's very important here, is that some attorneys and conservators actually, who are on the right side of the fence in these issues, are now under a significant level of attack. There's an attorney named Margie Michaels, who is a family law attorney in San Bernardino County and has come up against the forces of CARE and the CARE group over and over again. And Margie Michaels, who is actually extremely celebrated as an attorney, and as I think she's listed with one of the top 10 U.S. women in business, very well known down in San Bernardino County. She's run for, I believe it was the state legislator. She's been active. She's a peace activist. Well, now the courts are moving against her bar license. And she most recently had a case where Brian Hartnell was involved, and Brian Hartnell is one of the major CARE attorneys, and she was attempting to protect an elderly man and simply to get him his trial, because you can have a trial for this competency issue. And she's been trying to get him his trial so that he can get rid of the temporary conservator, because there doesn't seem to be any substantiation to the lack of capacity allegations. Well, the court is now moving against Margie Michaels in ways that is imperiling her license to practice law. Another case that I'm aware of is a conservator whose name is Pauline Clay, and she has been mostly operating in the Los Angeles court, and she is not of the pillage and plunder sort of school of conservatorship. And she has been, she was attempting to protect an elderly woman named Mrs. Taylor from a conservatorship that was becoming extremely abusive. And she was set up on a restraining order, which she was never served with, and subsequently jailed for violating a restraining order she was never given service of. You know, none of this is legal.
It simply has some
resonance of legality. Though there's a restraining order, well, you have to serve someone with a restraining order in order for it to have any legal standing. And at this point, I understand that Pauline Clay is to my recollection, has gotten the court to admit that there was no legality with the restraining order. This is my best recollection. But at this point, Mrs. Taylor has lost all her assets to the conservatorship. They've been selling off her property, and she is on the verge of becoming homeless, the elderly conservator. So what we're seeing is that those who attempt to protect parties in this matter themselves become under attack.
Okay, so what about when they run the funds down, how long do they hang around?
How long do the conservatives hang around?
Right.
Well, what we're seeing is that in many of these cases, that when the money is gone, so is the conservatives. And it's very easy. I mean, if you've got an elderly person, very often, you know, may need medical care, and all you have to do is do what happened to Elizabeth Fairbanks, withhold the medical care. And that is under the decision of the conservator, the person who has control of the money and control of the life-making decisions.
So I don't see how a person could protect their parent or vulnerable child from this sort of thing if you've got this kind of racket going on.
Well, I believe very strongly that one of the best protections against cockroaches is to shine the light on them. And what we're attempting to do on this show and on other media, writing articles, doing radio, talking about this on some television shows, what we're attempting to do is to raise public consciousness that this is going on. And what we have seen is when the media gets involved in these cases, as with Helen Jones, who I previously mentioned was focused on by the LA Times in their Guardians for Profit series. Melody Scott, who was Helen Jones' conservator, backed off. When Helen Jones' picture made the front page of the LA Times, Melody Scott backed off. Unfortunately, Melody Scott has over 100 conservatorships, but she lost control of Helen Jones. So the more attention, I believe, that is paid to these nefarious goings on, the better the situation will become.
And what about these groups that you're talking about that are forming, you know, to help alert people on and how to protect and stick up for these people?
Well, the groups are really in their infancy, and there has been talk about hiring lawyers and defending the conservatives, and I think that's a very good idea. There's also been efforts to get more media attention. It's tough to get media attention to this issue, and that's another big red flag as to what is this really all about. And the Los Angeles Times series is much cited as a great expose on conservatorship. Well, the LA Times series on conservatorship was ready to be published in September of 2003. I was in discussions with one of the lead reporters for the series. Her name was Robin Field, And this was good to go in September of 2003. It didn't hit papers until November of 2005. It kept getting put off and put off and put off. And when it did get published, given what Robin Fields told me she had on these people, they might as well have published oatmeal. It was watered down to the point of real corruption of the impact that the series could have had. Now, interestingly enough, there was an outcry because of the LA Times series, and some of the legislators moved into action. Dave Jones, Senator Scott, all of California, proposed new laws and to protect the conservatives, and these laws were passed. There was an omnibus conservatorship reform act, I believe it was in 2006, and passed and signed into law by Governor Schwarzenegger, who turned around and line-item vetoed all of the funding to enforce the new law. So once again, we see there's something peculiar going on here.
Then there's big money in it.
I'm sorry.
I said there's big money in it then.
There's big money here. And there's also... there are deaths that are occurring people's deaths are being hastened by this process. So you have murder and money have married. Now that kind of sounds like mafia to me, but it's all getting rubber stamped by the judges, and in some cases, as with what we have determined is going on with the CARE group, it's getting heavily covered by the justice agencies.
It goes back to the fact that how does one try to protect themselves? I mean, it sounds to me like, I mean, if you had an elderly parent, I don't know that you'd want to stay in San Bernardino County or California even. There might be, places that have good conservatorships and where judges do their job and the courts do what they should do. Maybe shining light on those places might help to get people to take a look at those places and see how they can protect themselves or shake out some of the cockroaches.
Well, we're trying to shake out the cockroaches. We're definitely trying to do that. And I think that's a very good point that you raised here, Melody, because, we're looking at the cockroaches right now, and we're not really researching the cockroach-free zone because they don't seem to, the reports aren't coming in. Hey, my mother had a wonderful experience under conservatorship here. The reports that are coming in are the complaints. And the documented abuses. And it would probably be a very good idea to figure out where it's safe to grow old. They used to say, I don't want to raise my kids in this town, so we moved here. And maybe it's gotten to the point, well, I don't want to grow old in this state, So maybe it would be a very good thing to start figuring out which areas are uncontaminated by this sort of abusive process.
I mean, that you would think somewhat that might be a good selling factor for retirees.
Yes. At this point, I would not retire to California or to Florida, given what I know about those states and how they're treating their elders.
Well, they're getting kind of chastised nationally a little bit with their child custody system, too. At least Florida is. But I'm sure that's not, isolated, but I'm hearing a lot of cases on some of the media that I follow. And in fact, I know of one person that's just decided he was going to move out. He didn't want to, after hearing some of this horror stories. So, now, how long do you usually stay on and researching something like this before you decide to move on to another type of a story or issue?
I'll tell you something. I'm sticking with this story.
Okay.
I certainly write other articles for the Bulletin, but this is an issue that is not getting adequately covered by most of the press. And our series in the American Bulletin is entitled The Probate Murders, and we published part one and two. Part three will be published in our May issue, and I'm already working on researching part four. And we're going to continue to run these stories because almost no one else is. Just today, I had a brief conversation with a Rick Green, who is a reporter for the Hartford Courant, and he's covering this. And one of the things we discussed was, gee, nobody's covering this story. And he goes, gee, I know, it's like nobody's covering this story. And there are a few reporters out there who are stepping up to the plate, but there are many, many reporters who simply are not. And one of the sidebars in the first in our probate murders series was called Who Bought the Free Press? And this article went through looking at some of the papers in Southern California, particularly in the Inland Empire, and how they were either covering or not covering this conservatorship issue. And we found that almost uniformly the papers, and we were dealing with the Los Angeles Times, the San Bernardino Sun, the Riverside Press Enterprise, were either covering it inadequately or simply failing, refusing to cover the story. And what this indicates, again, is there's some electricity or resonance around this situation that is far, far exceeds what, I mean, this is a great story. Hey, you got judges and DAs involved, and they're all screwing up and breaking the law. Okay, this is a reporter's dream for an expose, but the reporters are backing off of the story, which indicates that there is something else going on here in terms of levels of influence.
Well, I would imagine you run into some hazards for your own self doing this sort of story.
I have run into some hazards, and I'm not really of a mind to go into the source of hazards I've run into. We'll just say that it is not
for the faint of heart.
I'm sorry, what?
Not for the faint of heart.
You have to have some guts because you're coming up against the power structure. And, for example, Mary Garofalo was a Fox 5 TV reporter out in New York City, and she'd been at that TV station for 20 years. She was the senior member of their investigative team. She's won 6 Emmys. She began to cover this story of the conservatorship abuse. She did a pretty darn good job. I saw both of her investigative reports, and the day after the second investigative report aired, she was called into the office and told her contract was not going to be renewed and she could go home.
That seems to be a rampant thing.
20 years on the job, 6 Emmys, and suddenly, bye. No explanation given, bye. So, once again, there's something going on with this. And if it was simply, you know, rotten egg conservators and attorneys and a couple bad judges, then the press would take care of them real good and real quick.
Well, but you even get this with Britney Spears, the conservatorship. And that's the one they'll let you report on, correct?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch that.
I said, you even get that with Britney Spears, the conservatorship. That would be a story that they would let you cover, correct?
Well, I mean, the Britney Spears conservatorship is getting some coverage. but let's see, the Britney Spears conservatorship would be a great intro to, well, what is conservatorship and who goes under conservatorship and is there possibilities for abuses here, and, but the reporters aren't going there. So it does appear to me that this is an electric situation. And given that we have, as I said before, the marriage of money and murder that is being protected apparently all the way up the ladder, at least in some of these hot spots, what we're seeing here is a very serious situation. I did send off an email to some members of the press down in Southern California, some folks like Orion Orr has been promising to cover the story and has not yet. And I'd sure like to encourage the members of mainstream media who may be listening in tonight to step up to the plate, because everyone, God willing, everyone is going to get old. And given the difficulty in figuring out how to protect yourself from this system, we all may fall into the grasp of some money-hungry people who want our life's earnings. And if it is so difficult to protect yourself from this, and if shining the light on the cockroaches is one way to do it, then I want to encourage other members of the media to step up to the plate and start covering this. Because they are not exempt. They are not exempt or protected from the perils of age.
You know, Janet, I have to commend you for, because I know this isn't your only hard-hitting story that you've got in there and really dug into some avenues that have had a bit of risk for the person doing the reporting. And it's, I'm glad to see that there's, you know, some people out there that are still doing this kind of journalism. And I really appreciate you coming on our program tonight.
I want to thank you so much for having me on the air, Melody. I'm very, very pleased that you had me on the air to discuss this.
Well, I was glad to have you, and I hope we can have you back again. And is there anything else that you'd like to say in closing for the end of the night here?
Well, I just would like to bring up that the American's Bulletin is covering this issue and is covering some other issues that the mainstream press is sort of backing off.
Is it on the Internet?
Sorry?
Is that paper on the Internet?
The paper itself is not on the Internet. We have a sort of a modest website that gives a little information about the paper, but the American's Bulletin is a bi-monthly, it covers national issues, and it is a mail out, you know, by subscription.
Okay.
So if you go to the website, which is americansbulletin.com, you can, you know, figure out what the paper's about and if you're interested in subscribing.
Okay.
And I also want to give a little plug for my radio show, which is called One If by Land, and it airs every Wednesday between 5 and 6 p.m. Pacific time. And you can, if you're not in Ashland, Oregon, you can hear it at kskq.org because it streams off the web.
Well, great. And I want to thank you again, Janet, and have a good evening.
Thank you so much, Melody.
Uh-huh. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.